at him. But now she felt that, for once, she could not do as he asked. It seemed to her that in London, just as Aunt Emmeline was trying to see into her niece's heart by painting her portrait, so she herself had begun in earnest an interrogation of her own future. She had come to believe, perhaps fancifully, that Tite Street, Chelsea was a more helpful address than Henrietta Street, Bath, in which to discover the road to be followed in the next bit of her life. She believed that this road should have about it some inevitability, that it should point in some kind of unerring line from which she wouldn't be tempted to stray. Jane knew that, for all her fame as the angel of the baths, for all her pride in the cures she seemed able to bring about, she didn't wish to spend her whole life as a nurse. She knew that she had to arrive, one day, at something that could be mastered and possessed. And it was as if, though still invisible to her, that something would be more likely to reveal itself to her in Aunt Emmeline's studio, in the ethereal, turpentine-scented air under the high skylight which had once let the rain fall on a half-made creation on the pottery wheel, than anywhere else. She also made good use of the library Emmeline had amassed, liking especially to lose herself in the myriad worlds conjured by Mr. Dickens, admiring the reach of his imagination, but somewhat dismayed by the sickly sweetness of many of his heroines, and wondering if she might write to Dickens suggesting that Lucy and Estella, to name but two, were somewhat marred by their own perfection. She felt tempted to remind the great author that girls could be as wayward in their minds as any young gentleman and might sometimes have dreams that did not begin with the letter M for marriage. It amused her to imagine a crestfallen look on the bearded visage of the famous man upon receipt of her letter, yet she knew that she would probably never write it. Instead, she began keeping a diary of her life in London, not only noting what she did, but what she felt about everything, and commenting very frequently upon her own reluctance to return to Bath. She knew she had a good reason to stay on in Chelsea. Emmeline was pleased with the way the portrait of her niece was taking shape. She told Jane she was particularly satisfied with her capture of her height and the way the white robes she wore had about them a realistic heaviness, a heaviness which Jane's body seemed to bear with an upright stoicism, even with a kind of nobility, entirely fitting to her character. But Emmeline admitted that she had not made the same kind of progress in her work on Jane's face. The features, still only sketched in, did not yet even look like Jane. And the artist was frustrated by this. She made her niece promise that she wouldn't leave until, at least you have eyes with which to see. Jane wrote to her father, commiserating with him upon the departure of Mrs. Hughes, upon Becky's insubordinate mood, and upon the inadequacies of the new nurse, but explaining to him that the portrait was of great importance to her aunt and that she really couldn't desert Emmeline until it had been completed. On the subject of Valentine Ross, Jane wrote, I am so sorry that Dr. Ross appears agitated and distracted. I have no idea why this should be so, but I venture one reason. Perhaps it might be that he has been too long working with you in Bath. Should you not ask him if he would not prefer to set up his own practice in Swindon or Swansea? Men cannot always keep finding contentment with what they have. Sometimes they must move on. After her letter was posted, she decided to think of all this no more. And then something happened which surprised her so completely that she wondered whether she hadn't wandered into a state of mild insanity. It occurred at one of the select soirees that Emmeline liked to give from time to time, to reassure herself that London society, or at least some bohemian section of it, still admired her and her work. These took the form of late suppers, served with champagne, at which the guests could come and go and wander, eat and drink as they chose, and sit anywhere they like, whether at Emmeline's table in the studio, on the stairs, on a Turkey rug in front of the fire, or even if they wished it, in Emmeline's bedroom. Patient serving staff, dressed in velvet breeches and white wigs, progressed up and down the house, carrying trays of glasses and dishes of chicken breast and aspic. Guests might cry out from odd corners of any room for champagne reinforcements. It had been known once for sexual congress to take place in a wardrobe, causing some disruption to Emmeline's long, brightly coloured gowns. The ambiance was louche and the talk mostly amusing and highly decorated. It was often remarked that in this house, the guests felt wickedly free to do exactly as they chose. Chez Emmeline was considered a marvellous place to be. For this particular soiree, Emmeline had invited some 30 people, Artists, sculptors, musicians, writers, professors of moral philosophy, publishers, actors and singers. Finding herself in this thrilling company, wearing her favourite scarlet dress and an opal necklace, Jane felt a hectic excitement take hold of her, as though she might have been a tall ship becalmed which had suddenly found the wind filling her sails. She let her glass be refilled with champagne many times, was amused and delighted to have her beautiful height commented upon by a mighty tenor, who had put no less than 6 pieces of chicken in aspic on his plate, to listen to the intimate woes of a writer who found himself in a featureless desert of non-creation, and to trade some amusing banter on the subject of the ever-changing landscape of the London art scene with a sculptor whose only aim, he said, was to make ugly things, to provoke the world into scoffing at his work.
"For what people at first scoff at later becomes the thing of greatest value. I exist to make money. Patience is the only commodity needed."
Feeling her head swim a little and needing to sit down, Jane took her plate of chicken to the staircase, a place where she habitually liked to perch for long periods of solitary time and listen to the lively passing and repassing of the horse-drawn traffic in this leafy corner of London. Here, exactly where she always chose to sit, she found a publisher by the name of Ashton Sims, a small, serious man of 45, sitting alone with his food, and she asked if she might join him. Ashton Sims, co-proprietor of the highly successful and lucrative publishing house of Kirkwall and Sims, stood up and bowed to her. He was, he said, an ardent admirer and purchaser of Emmalina Dean's work, and was more than enchanted to meet her niece. "I hear," he said to Jane, "that Emmeline is wrestling with a portrait of you. I wonder why she used the word wrestling." "Oh," said Jane, "this is what people always find themselves doing with me. They want to capture me, and I am reluctant to let that happen." Ashton Sims smiled. "I imagine that is very wise of you. You must talk to my wife, Julietta. Juliet is very vehement on the subject of men's ownership of women. She says Western society is primitive in this regard, and I suspect you would agree." "Well," said Jane, "I have never been to anywhere considered actually primitive, such as a forest in Borneo, where I'm told human heads are sometimes used as decoration. But I think Julietta is right. Men use women as chattels and adornments, and they just don't cut their heads off first." Ashton Sims exploded with laughter. At this moment, a dark young woman appeared at the foot of the stairs, and Sims called out to her, "Julietta, come up. You must hear Miss Dean's joke." Julietta Sims paused in the hall to have her glass refilled, then made her way towards the stairs on which her husband and Jane were sitting. She sat down just below them. When Ashton introduced her to Jane, Julietta set down her champagne glass and held out a slim, soft hand and placed it in Jane's with infinite tenderness, as though the two women had been friends in former times and were now meeting up again after a long absence. Jane felt the sweetness of the hand clasp and risked letting her gaze dwell on Julietta's face for a lingering moment. It had long been apparent to all in Emmalina Dean's circle of friends that Julietta Sims, Italian by birth, but made rather exquisitely pale by her long immersion in London's sunless weather, was a person of exceptional beauty. But perhaps no one had ever been as enthralled by it as Jane felt herself to be at that instant on the stairs. The light was soft and flattering, coming only from candles in 2 wall sconces. But even taking this into consideration, Jane knew that she was looking at a kind of human perfection seldom seen. Julietta's eyes were, of course, large and dark, and her nose admirably straight. But it was Julietta's mouth, wide but not fleshy, with a Botticelli Venus curve to the upper lip, which gave this face such extraordinary seductive power. Jane knew that she should look away, that Ashton Sims might reasonably be disconcerted by the length of time she was staring at his wife. But it felt to her that by drinking in the beauty of Julietta's features, she was bringing nourishment to her very soul. She wanted to weep or cry out in wonder. And she soon became aware that Julietta's hand was still held in hers, and that the intensity of her immersion in Julietta's face was returned by the young woman's enraptured gaze. At length, Jane turned aside, and Julietta turned away. When Jane dared to look at her again, it was to gaze upon the back of Julietta's neck, lit so sweetly by the candlelight, and at her dark hair piled into an elegant arrangement, ornamented with jewels and feathers. It was at this moment that Jane remembered Valentine Ross telling her how, at the Chopin concert in the Bath Assembly Rooms, he had longed to reach out and touch her hair. And some pity for him now found its way into her heart. For she at last believed she understood what he'd felt. Jane ached to do what he too had longed for. To reach out and stroke Julietta's hair, and then her neck, and then her bare shoulders beneath. This longing was so overwhelming that Jane feared her hand might stray towards Julietta of its own accord, but she controlled it by reaching for her champagne glass and calling to one of the manservants in the hall to come and refill it. As the servant ascended the stairs, Jane was aware of Ashton Sims staring at her with an unfathomable expression on his face. And even as he stared, she felt something touch her foot. She did not need to look down to realize that Julietta's left hand had crept under Jane's skirt and was now tenderly encircling her ankle. Chapter 12. Microscope. A cold winter had now tightened its grip upon Bath. In his morning walks, Valentine Ross had to fight against spiteful peltings of sleet or found his path up Beacon Hill covered with snow. Sometimes a freezing fog joined the smoke from 1,000 coal fires to wrap the city in a poisonous mist, and this, Ross felt, was the most punishing of all conditions, the one most likely to lay him low. Yet he pressed on blindly, determined to reach the top of Beacon day after day, not caring if he fell ill, or perhaps wishing to surrender to some fearful bodily condition that might still the agitation of his mind. By the end of each day's work, he began to experience the kind of deep tiredness that he imagined afflicted infantrymen on their terrible forced marches towards enemy lines. And this was how he now perceived his predicament, that he was enduring the difficult present in order to keep walking towards some defining conflagration, and that only when he'd come through this would his life resume any kind of normality. That he had no idea what form this catastrophe would take didn't trouble him at present. He knew that a man may live in close proximity to things he does not yet see correctly. But what he must do is try to be vigilant and attentive to all that surrounds him in order to find the path he should follow. To deepen this inquiry, Ross cleaned and polished his rayer microscope. He set it up on a table near the fire in his lodgings and spent his evenings examining, almost at random, minute entities swept from his floor. Coal dust, threads of wool from his hearth rug, flower petals, a fishbone, crumbs of bread, the leg from a dead spider. In every case, he was disposed to marvel at what he saw through the lens. The fishbone, in particular, struck him as a thing of complex beauty, containing within its cells a peculiar pearly light. The spider's leg, too, was admirable, like a tiny piece of medieval armor. The flower petal, so fragile and weightless, so dead-seeming, yet revealed an intricate branching of veins, as though it had the means within it to come alive again. And these things consoled Valentine Ross by their beautiful and secret complexity. He took to plucking out lashes from his eyelids, vainly hoping that the mild pain he inflicted on himself would still his mind. He placed the eyelashes under a microscope lens, examining the white bulb-like growth at each root, suggesting to him that if a lash were planted in the earth, it might begin to grow, and in due time unfurl minute black leaves. He knew that his thoughts were muddled, almost as if he were dreaming his life instead of living it. But he told himself that his existence had too little of the strange and miraculous about it now that Jane had gone, and his heart had nothing marvelous to feast upon. He remembered Edmund saying to him, as he prepared to traverse half the world, that he couldn't be reconciled to living without wonder. And it soothed Ross to think that he could find wonder in the detritus swept from his hearth, or from a sliver of matter tugged out from his eyelid. "The microscope," he announced to Sir William one morning, "reminds us that we are born blind to the intimate secrets of everything in the world. We should perhaps make more use of it in our work." Sir William Adeane, it seemed, was unwilling to address this subject at present. He'd been distracted in recent times. An epidemic of chest ailments had arrived in Bath. He did what he could for the sufferers, prescribing balsams and inhalations, but he was dismayed to realize that his patients didn't have a great deal of faith in these. They kept clamoring for Jane, for the angel of the baths to lead them to the hot bath to cure them with her touch. "I have a new nurse now, Nurse Peggs," Sir William patiently reminded them, but they were not happy. They were heard in their distress, not to blame their adored Jane for being in London, but to blame Nurse Peggs for not being Jane, and for possessing an ugly name. Square Peg was how they referred to her, stressing that Square Peg was not at all to their liking. And when word of this nickname reached Miss Peggs, she dismayed Sir William by stamping her foot so hard on the surgery floor that some of his surgical instruments bounced up and fell off the tray into the dust. He told her coldly that nurses should not stamp their feet. He made her crouch down and retrieve the lancet and the probe that had fallen and clean them with her apron. Nurse Peggs did this obediently enough, but as she did so, she began to sob uncontrollably, stammering out that she would not stay in Bath,
to be insulted with a vile nickname,
just because she couldn't fit
into a blasted angel's shoes.
It came to Sir William then, hearing his daughter mildly but jealously disparaged by Nurse Peggs, that he, no less than his patients, did not like this woman at all. Indeed, he earnestly wished her to depart from Henrietta Street and never return. But he knew that, on that very afternoon, he was going to operate on a man whose life he hoped to save by opening up his chest and taking out a tumour from his lung, and he could not possibly hope to succeed in this operation without the constant vigilance of a trained nurse. He thus made himself help Nurse Peggs to her feet and offered her the silk handkerchief he kept in the pocket of his frock coat. He could find no words to console her. He decided the handkerchief would have to be enough, but it was not enough. Nurse Peggs dried her eyes and flung the thing away. She then told Sir William that she was going to pack her suitcase and leave Bath on the first available omnibus. "Why do you not take the train?" Sir William could not prevent himself from asking.
"Train," said Nurse Peggs. "Terrible invention. Ruination of the world. I will not set foot on one of them."
It was at this moment that a knock on Sir William's door heralded the arrival of Mrs. Morrissey to announce to him what she'd been able to bring for his lunch. Seeing Mrs. Morrissey's face, smiling as it often was, and hearing her beginning to talk about a dish of rissoles, Sir William beckoned her frantically into the room, even as Nurse Peggs banged down the now tainted surgical instruments into their tray and strode towards the door. She pushed rudely past Clorinda Morrissey, and her footsteps could be heard running down the hallway.
"Away and away," said Sir William. "She is gone, the Square Peg, and good riddance. But dear Mrs. Morrissey, please do come in and close the door and tell me what I am to do."
Sir William sank down into a chair and passed his hands through his abundant hair. Mrs. Morrissey stood regarding him for a moment, then ventured, "You will have to tell me what has happened, sir, or else what can I advise?"
"What has happened," said Sir William, "is that my world has fallen apart."
Sir William indicated that Mrs. Morrissey should sit opposite him, in the chair where his patients habitually sat during a consultation. He noticed that she consulted the surgery clock before she agreed to do as he asked, and he knew that she couldn't stay long. She had her baking to return to, her tables to lay, but he fervently hoped that she would remain with him for a moment. Ever since Valentine Ross had introduced her to him, he had liked her. He saw in her the kind of independent spirit possessed by Jane, yet she was of a more amenable and gracious disposition, and her voice was soft and calm.
"All my trouble stems from Jane's departure," said Sir William. "Not only do my patients clamour for her on and on, on and on, but I can by no means get her to agree to come back to Bath, not even for Christmas. She will not do it, telling me my sister needs her in London for a portrait she is painting. And then my cook leaves, a lot of mumbling about dry goods and non-payment of wages, and out she walks from one day to the next. But for you, we would have no lunch of any kind."
"Well, sir, it's only simple fare."
"It may be simple, but it has saved us. I thought all might go on calmly here after you helped us out, but now my nurse is scuttling for the omnibus, some foolish business about a nickname."
"A nickname?"
"Yes, and tears, as you witnessed, all for that futile reason. But tell me how I'm to open a man's chest this afternoon and endeavour to save his life under circumstances like these."
Mrs. Morrissey fanned her face with her hand, as though it might have been too warm in the room, when in fact it was cold, with a damp fog pressing at the window pane.
"Open a man's chest?" she said. "Lord in heaven! And I sometimes think that folding enough air into a Victoria sponge to make it rise is difficult enough."
Sir William now found himself smiling. Only moments before, he'd felt as if he would have nothing to smile about again in all this present time. And now Clorinda Morrissey had succeeded in spreading a small grin across his severe features.
We all have our talents, he said. And I think it's high time I told you properly how much Dr. Ross and I appreciate your pies and puddings. I do declare that you're keeping us alive. Well, said Mrs. Morrissey, but not alive enough, Sir William, isn't that so? What do you mean, Mrs. Morrissey? Well, now, I'm thinking of Dr. Ross. To my eyes, he seems anxious of late, and he does not look well. I know. You are quite right. You have lighted on another of my troubles. There is something the matter with him. I have asked him many times what it is, but he won't give me any answer. If I were to lose Dr. Ross...
He used to come to Camden Street quite frequently to take some Assam and smoke a cheroot. But after that day when he met your daughter there, I do not often see him. I only observe him here and I note.
He met Jane in your tea room?
Yes, just before she went away. And perhaps I should not speak of this, but it did seem to me as though there was a little misunderstanding between them during the tea.
What kind of misunderstanding?
I don't know, Sir William. Miss Jane left rather abruptly, and Dr. Ross seemed downcast after she'd gone. Sir William now fell silent. He began staring at the fire, which had burned very low. Clorinda Morrissey watched him with some tenderness. It came into her mind that many of the men she'd met since coming to England, including the amiable Sir William, appeared confused about one thing or another. She didn't know precisely why this should be the case, unless... And she knew that only a woman could have dared give voice to this thought. Society expected such vigilance, such leadership, such perpetual certainty from them, about everything from politics to manners, from monetary investments to questions of morality, that their vision of the world was as crowded and cluttered as a vast emporium of second-hand bric-a-brac, and that much of what passed in front of their noses, they did not veritably see.
Chapter 13. Tumor. The solution to being able to perform the lung operation that afternoon lay, in the end, with Valentine Ross. He put a sign on the front door of Henrietta Street to say he was indisposed and regretted that he could see no patients that day. He then studied such notes as Sir William Medine had made on the case of the man with the tumor, helped Sir William prepare the operation table, and stood ready to help with this difficult and dangerous task. The patient was a florid man of, perhaps 55 years, a Mr. Latimer, a prosperous owner of a glue-rendering factory situated at the lower end of the city, about whose noxious emissions of foul-smelling steam there was much helpless complaint. It was also known that many beautiful living horses were slaughtered only to feed the glue-vats with their bones, their sad flesh cut away and rotting in heaps in the open air, which attracted vermin to the area. Bath residents were vocal in their condemnation of Latimer's fearful enterprise and its desolation of an entire area of the city. But Latimer had made very satisfactory money from his glue and would not be moved to change his practices or resite his factory. When Latimer came in, both Ross and Sir William noted that he appeared quite calm. As he lay down on the table and his shirt was removed, he told the doctors that he had great faith. He said, "My faith is of two kinds. A belief in God that he does not wish me to die yet, and a belief in Sir William's skill." Valentine Ross privately thought that a third kind of faith should have been added to his list, faith in his money, that it could buy him the best private care that was to be had in Bath, thus avoiding being placed in a hospital bed, where contagious diseases put so many at risk. But Ross said nothing on this subject, and simply went about his preparations with quiet care. He told Latimer that in a few moments he would be given a lithion, a dose of gas confected from sulfuric acid and ethyl alcohol, and named for the river Lethe, in which, in classical mythology, souls immerse themselves in the waters of forgetfulness. This administration would make him immune to the pain which was to follow.
"I have not, alas, had the time in my extremely busy life as a man of commerce, to study classical mythology," said Latimer, as if this were a boast he could be proud of. "But I take your word for it." "We will work very carefully, but as fast as we can," said Sir William. 10 minutes from now, the tumor will be visible to us, and we will sever it cleanly, so that nothing remains.
Your lung will be cauterized against excessive bleeding and infection, and your chest cavity sewn up. When you wake, you may feel as if you've suffered some bruising, as though a hard-hoofed animal might have inadvertently kicked you in the chest. A hard-hoofed animal, said Latimer. Do you mean a horse? Not necessarily. It'll cause you some pain, but we will put you in a bed and watch over you. You may take a little laudanum, and then you will sleep again, confident that your tumor is gone. I foresee for you a long and prosperous life. I certainly hope so, said Latimer. I have just bought a new house in North Parade, much larger than my former property. I wish to enjoy some soirees there, for what is life without entertainment? Indeed, smiled Sir William. Are you ready, then, to be entertained by the Lethion? Now, the two doctors were swapping blood from Latimer's opened chest and peering in at the expansion and contraction of the left lung. What they had expected to find was a bulbous mass, a distinct heaping up of tissue like a carbuncle, which Sir William's lancet stood ready to slice away. But there was no such growth visible to them. They kept swabbing, and the flow of blood into the cavity slowly diminished, giving them better sight of the base of the lung, which was where Latimer had experienced pain so serious it had sometimes caused him to choke and vomit, and where they expected the tumor to be found. That it was not there puzzled them into silence. They kept looking at each other, and then back into Latimer's chest. The patient snored. The doctor swabbed and stared and swabbed and stared again. Sir William administered more lethion. That a patient should wake during an operation was a rare occurrence, but not unheard of. Severe pain could nullify the effects of the ether, and the screams of those who found themselves awake in the middle of a cutting were terrible to hear. Many died instantly of shock. After a few more minutes had passed, Ross, remembering the alteration of minute things he'd seen under the microscope, bent down and put his face very close to the breathing lung, willing himself to look unerringly at it, as though his eye could transform itself into the microscope's lens. Above the operating table, the gas mantle cast a white light on the moving flesh. Wielding a small probe, Ross explored the lung tissue, and what he then perceived was this tissue was not exactly as he knew a healthy lung should look or feel. It was, instead, infested. This infestation consisted of microscopic nodules, some as minute as a grain of caviar and some the size of a frog's egg. They were whitish in color, but a few were now seen as veined through with a livid purple. There were too many of them to count. Ross drew Sir William's attention to them.
Not one tumor, Ross said. What appears to be scores of embryo tumorae. I think they will spread and choke the lung. By opening them to the air, we may have inadvertently hastened that spread.
Sir William stared. He could now see the tiny, poisonous nodules clearly. But confused by this cruel diagnosis, he felt himself for once to be at a loss.
What can we do? He asked. We could cut the largest of them out, said Ross. But beyond that, nothing. We are looking at a death.
Sewn up and bandaged with infinite care, Latimer now lay in the back room in Sir William's house, where those who had undergone traumas of all kinds were put to rest and recover. Normally, it had been Jane who presided over this recovery, if necessary, sleeping on a cot at the patient's side or keeping vigil all night long. But there was no Jane, nor indeed any Nurse Peggs, so Ross suggested that they might take it in turns to nurse poor Latimer through the night. Finding himself awake in a different room, in a comfortable bed, and being dosed with laudanum, Latimer was brought to the great hope that his operation had gone successfully, and that his tumor now resided in some enamel dish, later to be shown to him as proof of his imminent recovery. He turned his head to see Sir William Adeen sitting by his side, holding the laudanum jar.
Sir William, said Latimer, was all well? Will I soon be dancing a quadrille in my new house?
I sincerely hope you will, said Sir William. But I must tell you that your recovery may be slower than you expected.
Why so?
What we found was,
more than one tumor. We have excised all that we could find, but do not be surprised if the pain in your lung lingers a little. There were many small wounds, you see, instead of one. But we will send you home to your wife with a good supply of laudanum, and we would advise you to rest.
You mean, said Latimer, that I am going to pay you for something which is incomplete?
That is the nature of surgery, said Sir William Camley. It can only cut out what it can see.
In the dark hours while Latimer slept, Ross came to take over the vigil from Sir William. Ross expected Sir William to go gratefully to his own bed, but the surgeon didn't move from the patient's side.
Sit down, he said to Ross. For you and I have things to discuss, and this quiet night seems a good time to talk about them.
Ross did as he was told, but not without foreboding. He prayed that Sir William was not going to mention Jane's name. He was not a man who liked lying. Indeed, he detested Bath society, sometimes for its habit of lying, and had resolved, in his own dealings, to follow a path of truth as far as he was able. But he knew that if Sir William was going to ask him what happened between him and Jane, he would have to lie. What was clamped about his heart, what he struggled with on cold morning walks, what he longed not to feel, this debilitating sorrow and disappointment, was only bearable if he could conceal it from the world. To have to admit it to Jane's father, to the one man who loved her in his own way, no less than he did himself, would only bring him further suffering by adding humiliation to his woes. He felt that his situation would then become so unbearable that he would have to leave Bath and then never return. Sir William got up and put some coals on the small fire. A northerly wind keened in the chimney stack and blew smoke back into the room. Sir William turned and asked abruptly,
"Was it on your account that Jane went away?"
"On my account, sir? Why would you suppose that?"
"I do not necessarily suppose it. I merely note that something happened to send Jane to London without any warning, something she never spoke of to me. I also cannot fail to notice that since her departure, you have not been yourself. There seems to be a matter that is causing you grief, and I have begun to wonder whether it's Jane's absence."
"Of course I miss Jane," said Ross, as brightly as he could. "We couldn't fail to miss her in this household, both you and I. But I am glad for her that she's enjoying London society. She works so hard when she's here, and it's quite right that she should have a change of scene."
Sir William looked closely at Ross.
"A very careful answer," he said, "but one that tells me nothing. Have you not something else to add?"
"I don't know what that might be," said Ross.
"Only that I've been worried lately on account of my brother. As you know, he's travelling very far away, and I haven't heard from him since the letter that told me he was ill. I'm very sorry if this worry has made me careless in my work." "No, I'm not implying that. Your work is always very good. It was you who discovered the small multiple tumours in Mr. Latimer's lung, when at first I could not see them. But I ask myself whether there have been other things that I have been blind to. For I heard today from Mrs. Morrissey that you took Jane to the tea room, that there appeared to be some quarrel between you and that Jane made one of the sudden departures for which she is well known."
"Oh," said Ross. "No, you have quite misunderstood. I did invite Jane to tea at Mrs. Morrissey's, but we had no sooner begun our charming half hour when she remembered that she'd agreed to escort a patient to the hot bath at 5 o'clock. She was enjoying her cake, but alas, she had to leave most of it uneaten. Such, as you know well, is her dedication to her duty."
"Ah," said Sir William, "so there is nothing between you?" "What is between us is what has always been there, respect and admiration, nothing more." "But cannot these respect and admiration undergo some metamorphosis which transform them into love?"
"Quite possibly," said Ross, "but not in this case."
Chapter 14, Vanishing Angel. The day after Emmeline's soiree, with the January darkness closing in upon the long afternoon, a caller arrived at the door. It was Julietta Sims. She was shown by the maid into Emmeline's studio,
where the artist was once again struggling to capture the features of her niece in the half-completed portrait. When Jane saw Giulietta, she was unable to stop a deep blush from suffusing the very cheeks which Emmeline was tentatively sketching in with dabs of pink and white. Emmeline put down her brush and looked at the two faces so intently held by the gaze of the other and believed she understood what was occurring.
"Giulietta, my dear," said Emmeline, "will you take some tea with us?"
"Thank you, Emmeline," said Giulietta, "but I will not stay long. I fear I'm interrupting important work, but it was only..."
"That you had something to say to Jane."
"Yes."
"Then let me leave the two of you together, unless you would prefer to go to Jane's room and talk to her there."
"Well, yes, why don't we do that, Jane?"
"Yes," said Jane, "if you do not mind, Emmeline."
"Of course not. I have much to tidy up here. You need not hurry in your conversation."
The two women went quickly up the stairs, and as they went, Giulietta reached out for Jane's hand. Giulietta Sims, great beauty that she was, had had many lovers since her marriage to Ashton Sims, and most of these lovers had been women. It was thus that when she found herself alone with Jane Adeane in her room, sensing perhaps that Jane was a virgin in all respects, she took it upon herself to make plain her passion at once, without modesty or fuss. She laid Jane down on her bed and kissed her mouth. Though Jane had never before been kissed in this way, Giulietta sensed at once that the embrace awoke in her feelings so powerful that whatever Giulietta had in mind to do, Jane would surrender to it. Giulietta took out the tortoiseshell comb which held her elaborate coiffure in place and let her dark hair fall in a silky curtain around Jane's face.
"Now," she whispered, "nobody can see us."
"I do not care," said Jane. "I do not care who sees us. I do not care about anything except this. Show me how to love you." Giulietta next undid Jane's bodice and pushed the clothes aside to reveal her breasts, caressing them first with her soft white hand and then fastening her lips on them. She liked to do this when she made love to a woman, to give the breasts tender attention, first sucking on them, then removing her own garments to take the other into her arms. She knew that this soft prelude, drawn out gently in time, could engender such a yearning wildness of desire in that select band of women lovers she named her beauties, that when at last her fingers reached down to begin to caress the almost hidden place where real pleasure kept its audacious secret, they could make a jouissance arrive almost immediately. Such was Giulietta's power that this ecstasy never brought to an end their surrender to passion, but only increased it, very soon making them crave her tongue where her hand had been. And Giulietta's tongue was very skilled. Among the beauties, the words, "J'ai envie de la langue de Juliette," became a teasing code between them, telling each other that it was a woman's knowing touch they craved, and that they craved it now. Whispered amongst themselves in polite drawing rooms, this little phrase could make them wild with desire, and sometimes lead them out into the dark night, telling their menfolk that they simply wished to breathe the night air, but in fact to lean against the trees of ancient parks and give each other the rapid but gorgeous satisfaction they almost never got from their husband's attempts at lovemaking. New to all of this, knowing nothing of the beauties, when Giulietta's tongue touched the place she knew men dreamed of discovering in her, she felt a white, pulsing delirium go through her. Jane cried out so loudly in wonder that Emmeline heard the cry two floors down, stopped in her work of tidying her studio, and said to herself,
"Now I know something more of who Jane is."
But Jane no longer knew who she was, only that she'd found Giulietta, and that she wished to make love to her for all eternity. When Jane and Giulietta at last descended to Emmeline's studio, Giulietta's hair once more put neatly up by the tortoiseshell comb, Jane's hand pressing against her lips to conceal the small wound on them made by Giulietta's kisses, they found a note from Emmeline saying that she'd gone out. The two young women sat down by the fire, and Giulietta said,
"I must leave very soon. Ashton will be home from his office, and he likes to find me there."
Jane got up, knelt down by Giulietta's chair, and clung to her skirts and to her slim body beneath them.
"What am I to do?" she said.
"Jane," said Giulietta,
We must live in the world. We must conduct ourselves as though there was nothing between us.
But how am I to do that? Jane asked. I've never known love of this kind before. People will only have to glance at me to know what I feel.
Julietta stroked Jane's hair.
We are lucky, she said. Your Aunt Emmeline has defied society in her life, and she will understand, I think, how you might now wish to defy it, just a little. She may allow me to come here from time to time.
From time to time? And what am I to do in the days and hours in between?
You will live them. You will take walks along the river and go riding in the park. You will play bézique. You will read. You will sit quietly for your portrait.
But I will scream out for you day and night.
And I will sometimes scream for you, for your great height, for your strong arms, for your ankle, which I first touched on the stairs. Then I will come to Tite Street.
Come tomorrow, or come back tonight in the middle of the night.
You would ask me to leave Ashton's bed in the early hours?
Yes. You cannot love Ashton, you love women.
I love both.
You let Ashton make love to you?
Yes. He's my husband, and I would like to have another child.
You have a child already?
Yes. My son Marco, he's 4 years old.
Jane looked up at Julietta's perfectly arranged features. Her thought was, I would like to be this little Marco, held in his mother's arms, the object of her adoration, flesh of her flesh, the living manifestation of her future, her only boy, the one she will never leave until her death. At supper with Emmeline, which Jane was almost unable to eat, she said when the maid had retired to the kitchen, I am lost to Julietta Sims.
Yes, said Emmeline calmly.
Irretrievably lost.
Yes, I know this.
Am I now in a play, a tragedy of some kind?
Emmeline sipped her glass of white wine, regarding Jane tenderly over the top of the glass. After a long moment, she said,
We must finish the portrait. I think I know how to finish it now.
I asked you if I was in a tragedy, Aunt Emmeline.
And I said that I knew how to finish the portrait now, to put passion, not tragedy, into your features. But this may not take very long. Then I think you must return to Bath.
You're afraid I'll make a scandal in your house?
No, not at all. I'm afraid that your heart will be broken. It's known in a certain group in London society that Julietta
has lovers.
Women, in particular. I've heard them referred to as Julietta's beauties. She never chooses ordinary-looking people. She chooses those whom she finds exceptional. I expect she was infatuated with you straight away, the moment she saw you.
And I with her.
But you must not stay to suffer, Jane. Now that you know a little more about your body and its pleasure, why do you not agree to marry your doctor in Bath? From what you say, he's an honourable man, and such creatures are rare in English society. Of course, all men need to be taught about women's sexual needs, because they have no concept of what they are. But they can learn to be very good lovers, too. Your doctor would soon learn, and you would have him in your bed every night.
I don't want him in my bed at all. I could never love him in that way.
Of course, you think that now. But I merely plant the idea in your mind.
Jane was silent. She reflected that while she'd been making love with Julietta, she'd experienced a kind of near drowning in some dark element into which she'd never before fallen. It was as though, during the 2 hours she and Julietta had spent in sexual abandon, the white angel had vanished. Vanished completely, with all her power and intelligence to be replaced by someone else. Someone who was no longer any kind of angel, whose mind was clouded, whose eyes were blind, whose hands had no skill, who yearned for nothing except her lover's touch, and who would surrender everything to lie in that deep ocean of pleasure. But she realized that she did not at all admire this new person. Miss Jane had always carried her great height around with a manifest degree of self-congratulation. Now, she felt as though this tallness had been taken from her, and that she'd become small. So small that people might pass right by her and not notice her at all.
Chapter 15. Leon's New Idea. After the first few readings from the Gospel of St. Luke, Sir Ralph Savage had made clear to Edmund Ross that a portion of each day was to be spent in the forest glade, telling and retelling the life of Jesus Christ. But it was only in this tranquil place that the Raja wished to listen to this narration. He told Edmund that the fusion of his English voice with the words of his Saviour and the orchestra of the forest created in him an exquisite tranquility of mind. Now, however, great storms began to fall upon Borneo. The sky above the forest seemed to gather itself into a perpetual night and let wash upon the world so vast a curtain of water that it obliterated everything moving beneath it. The gibbons hid away, cradling their young. The grasshoppers and crickets crouched motionless in havens of moss and leaves. The bats hung silent in their caves. Even the herons along the river had stepped back from the water's edge to the darkness of the mangroves and stood hunched under puffed-up feathers watching the water rise. The snakes roped themselves to leaf-sheltered branches and closed their eyelids, opening them only upon the sword slashes of lightning. In the glimmers of white light, the snakes' eyes were like jewels, unyielding and shining. Edmund lay in his bed, glad that he was inside Sir Ralph's great exaggeration of a house and not in some fragile hut or stilted longhouse swaying in the wind. He felt anguish not at his own state of idleness, but rather at his cowardly savouring of this pause in his endeavours. He listened to the insect and animal world gone silent, making way for all that the storms could do. He heard trees falling. He meditated upon the realization that everything upon the earth is at the mercy of something else. He knew that his life had paused in this place only because his collecting equipment had been taken from him, and because Sir Ralph's mind had placed him enthralled to the daily Bible readings. But now the rains had come, and the rivers were swelling, and he still had not found the means to replace his lost equipment. How would he ever be able to continue with his journey? Meanwhile, the Raja's mind was turning upon a new enterprise. As with the Savage Road, the idea had come to him from Leon, who had begun to berate him for letting too many people under his supposed governance languish in poverty and idleness. The building of the road had brought them some relief from this, but now, apart from the cultivation of rice and vegetables and the rearing of fighting cockerels, they were falling back into a state of inertia and sadness. "Theirs is a great sorrow," said Leon. "They are very poor. Some will soon run amok. Maybe they'll kill you. Plenty Rajas killed in Borneo in past time, because they do not think of their subjects anymore." "It is not true that I do not think of them anymore," said the Raja.
"I am not seeing it, that thinking," said Leon.
"You may not see it, but my mind is always turning on ways to improve their world."
"You say your mind turns, but this mind is an empty cage, like a mouse wheel. It does not go anywhere."
Sir Ralph knew that there was truth in what Leon had said, and he felt that it was the Savage Road, in all its uselessness, which was to blame. If only the road had had some destination, had led to some mighty portal opening up upon an enterprise where trading could have taken place, then both he and the people would have prospered.
"What more can I do, Leon?"
asked Sir Ralph.
"You listen to me, Raja."
"I always listen to you."
"That is very right. And my mind has turned. But my wheel is not empty. I have talked to the people along the river. We make a plan for you."
"What plan?"
"You will build a cannery."
"A cannery? For what?"
"For fish. A cannery with steam power. Cut trees to burn. Bring engineers from Singapore to design the canning sheds and show how to shape tin and seal with lead."
"Where have you learned all this?"
"I am vigilant, Raja. While you lie in your hammock, I am travelling to the markets in Kuching. I see inferior tins for beef and sardines. Everything's leaking and stinking, but I will discover how to make tins properly sealed." Hearing of this new idea, Sir Ralph felt a familiar excitement at the prospect of starting something radical and unexpected. Nobody but he, after all, had imagined his magnificent house, but there it stood, in all its bewildering grandeur. If that could appear in the middle of the forest, then why not other miracles? Why not, when the rivers teemed with fish a canning factory to give everybody work and pay and purpose. Sensing that he'd got Sir Ralph's attention, Leon went on. After the rains, hundreds of big, soft-shelled turtles in the Sedang come to feed near the mangrove banks. Men spear and kill, women chop turtle meat, boil in brine, then to the cannery and send for sale. Catfish also. Subaru and frogs, import-export.
Oh, very good, said the Raja. Import-export? Where did you learn that? From the traders in Kuching? But I like it. Import free from the river, export to Singapore for silver.
That is it, Sir Ralph. We make plenty money.
Excellent. You see how helpful you are to me.
I will form a company, the Savage Cannery Company. No more sadness.
Good, said Leon.
And now, Sir Ralph, no more Jesus reading. Sir Ralph looked at Leon, who was standing in the darkness of the evening near a window. A garish lightning flash arrived and, for a moment, lit up his slender body in a magnificent silhouette, confirming in Sir Ralph's mind the godlike beauty of his paramour, the wisdom of his own erotic choice. But he had not expected Leon's last request. He knew it was useless to try and explain to Leon the peace and harmony which Edmund's Bible readings brought to his mind, and the way they led him to a spiritual excitement that was not totally separated from bodily arousal, and yet seemed to confirm day by day the loving Christ's tender understanding of his yearnings. He was sometimes able to believe that a lasting state of absolution was coming near, a forgiveness for all his sins, past, present, and future. If his thinking about this was not perfectly rational, it did not stop him from believing that if the ecstasy in his mind, as he lay listening to St. Luke on his hammock, could be brought to a furnace so strong that he might faint from its power, then this gift of absolution would arrive from his Savior.
Edmund Ross talks to me as if from my God, he told Leon. You must not be jealous of this.
So you will not send him away?
I do not need to. In time he will leave. He has his own mission to accomplish.
I wish him to leave you now, Sir Ralph.
So you say, but I cannot grant this. Not yet.
When will you grant this?
I've told you. He will grant it of his own accord. He wants to find and capture the birds of paradise. When the rains are over, he will leave. He will sail to the Aru Islands, and he will not come back.
Chapter 16, Where the Red Ants Led. As suddenly as they arrived, the storms moved away. The sun returned, and the forest exhaled its lungfuls of water as hot vapor into the sky. The relentless cry of the gibbon was heard again. The island showed itself as a thousand shades of flickering and shining green. Sir Ralph went out into his garden, where he found several small snakes on his lawn, motionless in the hot sun, the wet grass steaming all around them. He let them be and called Leon and Edmund from the house. He told them to put on their boots. They were going to walk out along the Savage Road, inspect the storm damage, then make their way to the river to mark out a possible site for the cannery. As Sir Ralph had feared, the road was disturbed. Much of its surface dressing had leached away into the forest, and even the white stones beneath had moved, here and there, kicked up by the violence of the rain, so that parts of the highway now stood in a state of potholed ruin. It was littered with fallen branches and leaves, nuts and berries torn off their stems in the wind. Rats were busy ingesting their scattered debris. Sir Ralph stood still and stared. That nature had been so harsh towards a thing built to endure, a thing which bore his name and over which so many had labored, he felt as a wound to his heart. He kneaded his chest, and he squatted down and took up a few white stones, pressing them back into one of the potholes, as if he himself now planned to cure the road of its suffering single-handed. Liam went to his side.
Don't be a nincompoop, my Raja, he said. More rain will come. But after all the rains, the people will work to make the road better. You don't do it now.
Sir Ralph knew his lack of patience to be a fault in him, for which Leon was justified in mocking him. While his house was being built, he'd walked round with a drover's whip, never letting it fall upon the backs of his laborers, but nevertheless cracking it against the walls, announcing his dissatisfaction with the slow pace of the work. And during his brief time in England,
he found himself driven to fury by the willingness of even the cleverest of men to stand and wait, when very often they should have acted. He asked himself how anything was done or made in a country where stoic detachment and the prolongation of decision-making were considered to be such unspoken virtues. Now he felt like weeping. He would perhaps have wept had Leon not reminded him that they were going to the river to determine where the cannery was to be sited. But the word cannery sparked a tiny flame of optimism in his brain. He could almost immediately see and hear the marvelous workings of such a place, like an enormous threshing machine running on steam-driven belts. He stood up, and they walked on, soon veering away from the road and taking the path to the river. This path was slippery with mud, flooded in parts, and long before the three men reached the river, they could hear the risen water in a new turbulent conversation with itself, growling up against boulders, laughing down rapids. Leon stopped and turned to Sir Ralph. "Sir Ralph," he said, "before we can build the cannery, you must bring the Savage Road here, to this place where we are."
"You are right," said Sir Ralph, "for the lumber haulage, for the steam machinery.
But I would suggest that we make not just one, but many branches of the road, all arriving at the cannery site, as soon as the rains are over." Then began a discussion about how near the river the new enterprise should stand. Sir Ralph envisaged it, rising on stilts, an enormous longhouse, almost at the water's edge. To bring the netted fish and the wounded soft-shell turtles as near as possible to some system of belts, carrying them to the building where they would be adroitly decapitated, eviscerated, cleaned, filleted, and boiled before being sealed into cans would ensure, he felt, the efficiency and speed of the operation. But Leon reminded him that the river was like the sea. Nothing about it was stable or predictable. In days or even hours, it could rise two heights of a man. If the cannery was situated too near to the river, it would be at risk from flooding. The success of the whole undertaking, of what Sir Ralph now called in his mind the cannery of salvation, would depend upon getting the positioning of the factory precisely right. This, in turn, would depend on engaging an engineer to work out a plan for the enterprise. While Sir Ralph and Leon walked on, talking as they went, Edmund was distracted by glimpsing two large swallowtail butterflies, well known to him as Papilionidae, sucking fruit and moisture from a fig tree not far from the path. He stood very still, observing them, moved as he always was by their jewel-like colors, metallic blues and greens adorning their wings, with here and there patches of crimson which always reminded him of the flash of red above a capercaillie's eye, a wonder seldom seen, but one that had once moved him to tears. Had he had his butterfly net with him, he might have captured both insects with one skillful flick of his arm, but without any equipment he was helpless. Edmund stepped quietly from the path towards the swallowtails. He saw that they were so concentrated on the rain-washed figs that they didn't move at his approach. He longed to touch them, but even as he reached out his hand, they spread their huge wings and rose silently into the tree canopy. Edmund stood where he was, watching the butterfly's graceful flight and listening to the forest alive once more with bird and animal cries. Looking down at his feet, he saw a column of red ants flowing across his boots and smiled at their insouciance. He didn't move, but let the column surge on. It was then that he noticed he was standing in a small clearing and that nailed to a palm was a cracked and faded wooden sign which read, "Claims Office, 500 yards. An arrow pointed in the direction the ants were traveling, and it amused Edmund to wonder if, where once a gold mine had been worked, these courageous tiny creatures had found ideal terrain in which to nurture their queen and establish the epicenter of their vast and complex society. He shook the ants from his boots, but began to follow alongside the column. Although saplings and trailing lianas stood in his way, he saw that he was walking on what once had been a well-trodden path, and while knowing that he should have turned back and rejoined Leon and Sir Ralph, he felt insatiably curious to discover whatever traces remained of what had once been a gold mine. Inherent in this curiosity, he knew, with some shame, was the notion that man's search for precious metals over the whole circumference of the earth is a quest without end. yet also subject to his impatience, fatigue, and disappointment, thus leading to the idea that wherever treasure has once existed, small vestiges of it can often remain long after it has been abandoned. After a few moments of walking, the ant column veered leftwards into the dense forest. But so certain was Edmund that the ants had selected the old mine terrain as their home that he decided to follow them. Feeling at once the absence of his crease with which to hack away the vegetation impeding his progress, he nevertheless stumbled on, bending everything aside with his hands. A cloud of moths shook itself from a fallen tree and rose in the air, passing directly over Edmund's head, some of them touching his hair with their wings and snagging on it. Edmund brushed the moths away. He stopped for a moment, wondering whether, after all, he shouldn't rejoin Leon and Sir Ralph, but realized he'd come quite far now. The ant still traveled at his side, in a smooth flow over roots and mossy stones. A large monitor lizard darted suddenly from a camouflage of leaves, snapped up a mouthful of the insects, and disappeared. A few of the ants began to run in circles of distress, but the main column surged on, closing the gap on itself left by its dead comrades. And Edmund found that he now felt a sentimental affinity with the red ants. He wanted to follow where they led. He also told himself that if they were indeed leading him to the abandoned mine, he would enjoy apologizing to the Raja for his sudden disappearance from the walk to the cannery site if he could put into his hands a tiny powdering of gold. Most importantly, however, this feeling of being deep in the forest alone, alert to everything that he might be about to witness, horror and wonder, both, brought back into Edmund's heart that familiar excitement which had fed his dreams of discovery and which, since his illness and his sojourn in Sir Ralph's house, he feared he might have lost forever. He no longer minded that he didn't have his knife. His face was scratched as he moved forward, his hands pricked by thorns and chafed by bark. But he was happier than he had felt for a long time. When he saw a king cobra coiled among the roots of a banana tree, he walked nonchalantly past it. He didn't know how much time had passed when he became aware of a change in the light above the canopy. He stopped and looked up and saw that storm clouds were once again gathering. Thunder was just audible, far off as yet, but no doubt coming nearer. Edmund sighed. He had often before been in the forest in drenching rain, but he also knew that a chill always followed if shelter was not quite quickly found. Now, perhaps, he could have wished himself back on the path to the river with Leon and Sir Ralph, but when he turned and looked behind him, he was no longer certain in which direction the river lay. He cursed his lack of compass. Of all the things that had been stolen from him, the loss of the compass troubled him the most. "Follow the ants," he muttered. "Have faith in their purpose." And he told himself that when the mine was reached, and it surely couldn't be very far off now, there would he come upon some remnant of a gold miner's hut or cabin, decayed with time but quickly made serviceable as a temporary refuge. In this place, he would wait until nature changed her mind again and the sun returned. And he fell to imagining what he might find there in the gold miner's hovel. Some ancient cans of bully beef, a shovel with a broken haft, a sluice box, once rattled back and forth, almost to its destruction, but yet still intact, still powdery with the dirt through which some wretched digger had hoped to glimpse the shining substance that would alter his life. Chapter 17. Valentine Revisited. The year had turned, and the first signs of spring were visible in Chelsea. Emmeline Adeen, with Jane at her side, was now wiping her hands on a turpentine-soaked rag and looking with satisfaction at Jane's finished portrait. The aspect which Emmeline had found for her niece's face was one of severity, suggesting both a clever mind and perhaps even a stubborn one. But for a long while there had been something missing from the features, something the painting had not caught. Emmeline had seen at last what this was. She had then reshaped Jane's mouth very slightly, giving it an almost imperceptible upward curl on one side. The tiny alteration now suggested the humor and the fondness for irony, which was so much part of Jane's nature, but which had been absent from the portrait until Emmeline had made this final adjustment. She now asked Jane if she liked the portrait, and Jane said, "I think I'm going to like it as I like myself,
On certain days, not at all, and at other times, I'm going to adore him modestly.
Good, said Emmeline. As long as those days of adoration occur quite frequently, I am happy. And now, Jane, you must talk about the future. I believe it is time for you to go back to Bath.
Jane walked away from Emmeline and went to the window, looking out at the sunshine falling upon Tite Street. She thought, I've begun to adore everything here. I adore the grey pavement. Are you tired?